Pittsburgh are rolling down that eastern seaboard.
1217 here on The Shilling Show. Free and reduced radio. Yes, radio for everyone here on The Shilling Show. Just turn it on and push the button and it's free. Do you like that? All right. It is my pleasure to welcome back to The Shilling Show. We have a monthly engagement, and I'm so pleased that he joins us here every month. David Murata is president of Murata Wealth Management, and on the web you can visit them at emurata.com. David, thanks for being with us here on The Shilling Show today.
Thank you.
There is a very important topic at hand right now because we're at graduation time. And before we get into the specifics of this, the topic today is learning to live on your own. I'd like you to share your story about learning to live on your own, and I'll share my story, and then we'll get into some of the specifics and your recommendations for people. Is that a story that you can share?
Yeah, probably one of the best things that ever happened to me that my parents ever did was they told me exactly what their finances were. I can remember at age 4 knowing that our home mortgage was about $12,500 at an interest rate of 4%. And I knew what my mom spent on groceries each week. And for so many families, finances are this hidden close to the chest secret. I think the parents are afraid that if the children knew how much their parents made, they would be mad at them for not saving more for their college education and spending more for them. Because many families it's a secret and it's almost an embarrassment, and they live sometimes hand to mouth, even though they make a tremendous amount of money, and they pretend that they're poor, but they're not really poor, and they could put more money away for savings. So the best thing that ever happened to me was my parents were open and honest about their finances, and as a result, when I got graduated from college, I got married 2 weeks later, my wife and I started our life together. I already felt like I knew what it took to run a family, and I knew what it took to save and invest and grow rich. And so many graduates today find themselves really ill-prepared for the world of financial responsibility. They never saw how their parents lived when they were poor, and they never heard those stories because their parents never told them about it, and their parents never took them through the process of why they spend their money and how they spend their money. And so as a result, they're on their own, and they're coming from a budget, a college budget, which is primarily spent on eating out, entertainment, and gasoline. And yeah. Now all of a sudden they have real world responsibilities, and they have no sort of categories to put that in.
You know, it's very interesting to compare and contrast this, because my parents were the kind of holding it close to the vest parents. Although I must say my parents did a really good job in teaching me how to be a fiscally responsible individual, because I was able to purchase a home at the age of 22 because I'd been thinking about it and saving for it since I was 12 years old. So it wasn't that I didn't learn how to take care of my finances, but I remember them. You know, I never saw my dad's paycheck. I remember one time him telling me he was making $100 a day, and he was kind of proud of that. This was back in the 70s maybe, and he was up there at the time and thought that was really good. But other than that, we didn't get into it too much, and it was kind of like, you don't talk about money. And I think the concern is that the kids were going to go tell their friends, like, oh, my dad makes this much money.
Right.
And so we didn't have that conversation, but certainly I learned to pay my bills responsibly. I saw my mother sitting at the table writing out the checks, and my parents had excellent credit, and so I saw that, and I absorbed that. But, you know, I also stuck around the house. I was the first one in and the last one out. I think that's an accounting principle, or maybe backwards of the accounting principle. But I stuck around for a while, and I lived at home. And I remember when my parents told me they were going to start charging me rent. And I thought that was outrageous, you know. And it's like, we're going to charge you, I don't know what it was at the time, $100 a month or something to stay in this house. And they were telling me that their parents charged them rent. And they'd been telling me this for some time, their stories about, you know, my mom charging her rent to live at home. And I thought, that's just wrong. There's something wrong with that. But I started paying them some money, and I didn't mind doing that. And after I got started a little while, and before too long, I was able to save up some more money and move directly into a house that I owned. I was never a renter until, about a dozen years or so after I purchased my first home. Maybe it was a little more than a dozen years, because at that point, I had owned another home and moved out of that one and wasn't sure if I was going to stay in California anymore. So we decided to rent short term. It turned out to be 5 years, but it was probably good timing that we didn't buy another house. But that was kind of my transition out of the house and being on my own. When you talk to parents, or when you're talking about parents talking to their kids about money, What do you say to the parent who says what my parents said? This is not our kids' business. We don't want them to know the particulars of the dollar amounts of these items because we don't want them telling their friends.
Yeah. One of the principles that I learned in financial planning is that generational financial planning, the most important thing that you pass on is your values and your perspectives. And it's very difficult to pass on your values and your perspectives on money without actually talking about concrete real-world examples. So kids whose parents smoke, they learn to smoke because they see it. The parents never sit down and say, okay, now here's how you smoke. They just see the parents smoking, and they say, okay, that's what parents do. That's what grown-ups do. Well, grown-ups spend time with finances and money, and they're responsible with that. And if you want to pass on your values, there are 100,000 opportunities every year to teach about your values. So, for example, if you're generous and you give your money away, who do you give to, and how do you decide who to give to, and how do you decide how much? And if you make a certain amount of money, how much goes into savings and how much goes into charity and how much goes into clothes and what do you value for those things? And how do you determine how to buy a car or how, what kind of insurance to get? All of those are decisions for values, and it's the values that is generational financial planning. So you're basically losing hundreds of opportunities to pass on your values to your kids and to help them cope with the world properly.
And they really need that. And I think the other thing that's interesting is something you mentioned at the very beginning. And we're talking with David Murata, the president of Murata Wealth Management, here on The Shilling Show at 1223-977-1070 is the phone number. You mentioned this whole issue of kids not seeing their parents when they were poor. Now, I saw my parents when they were poor, you know, they lived in a two-bedroom house and had a few kids in that house. And I saw them progress and move up, you know, through a couple of homes during our time. But, you know, they'd certainly practice deprivation during those early years and didn't drive always the fanciest cars and didn't have the biggest house and all the extras and were very frugal. But as the demographic changes and people are having kids at a later age, you know, my parents were maybe 22 and 25 when they had me or something like that. You know, far different from me. I'm not going to say how old I was, but I was far beyond there. So my kids are being born into this thing that you talked about where I'm not wealthy, but I'm certainly more comfortable than my parents were when they had us. And so how do you deal with that? Because there's such a high bar, an expectation that I'm born into this luxury and I want it the second that I move out of my house.
Yeah, and the children expect to have their parents' lifestyle immediately. I can tell you that family stories are probably one of the best ways of passing on. I can remember my parents talking about the last 2 years of my father's college. They were married. They were living in a Quonset hut. They had almost no money and all the different things that they used to have to do because they had no money. So sometimes you get a perspective of that. And then when you start out on your own, you don't expect to immediately be eating out every night, have a huge house, buying prepared food. You know that you're going to have to economize. The interesting thing is what we do pass on to our children are our values, but I'm a little bit worried today about what society values we're passing on to our children. The baby boom generation has a current sort of perspective on what you do financially, and the baby boom generation is the me generation, and you know, we're the ones that want to spend beyond our means, get in trouble with our mortgages, run into credit card debt, and live hand to mouth. Those are not the kind of values you want to pass on. And it's almost better if the baby boom generation did play it close to the chest, because the lessons that they would pass on as a whole are not the lessons that kids need today.
Absolutely. 977-1070 is the phone number. We have a line open for you right now. We also have a caller on line one. And Greg, how are you today? Thanks for calling The Shilling Show.
Hey, I love your show.
Thank you.
I've got a few comments. When I was 14 years old, I'm 51, my dad was a school teacher, and he didn't make a lot of money. But I wanted to farm, and so I started cutting grass. And by the time I was 14, I'd saved up $500 and bought 14 acres 6 miles down on Lynchburg Road.
Wow.
And I cut pulpwood and stacked it in the summers and rode my bicycle, had my chainsaw strapped on my back. And kids now don't want to do anything. Not all kids, but a lot of kids. And, you know, I've got four sons. Of course, I had a family breakup years ago. And those kids have been coddled. It's really a shame because I built up a small fortune by the time I was 30. Of course, I lost it all and had to start over at 40. And but I remembered what I used to do, and I just got up and went to work every day and pulled myself out of a hole. And that's, we've lost the notion of individual, rugged individualism, and we all feel like that somebody owes us something, not all of us, but a lot of us, and that's where we are today, and that's why we're evolving to a socialist state.
Yeah, you're completely right. First of all, congratulations. Most successful millionaires have lost a million first before they go on to their second million. And congratulations, too, for actually taking the initiative at 14. Both my kids started to work at 14. Both of them have significant savings. They're able to buy the things they want. Interestingly enough, their friends seem to live more lavish lifestyles with less money because it's all parents' money. And you're right. If kids don't work and they don't know how hard it is to earn money, they end up spending it. And really, the first time that they have a shock is when mom and dad don't have enough money to send them to college and they have to start going into debt. So you're right. The working at age 14 allows you to be able to sort of pay your own way and go on. And you're also right that one of the lessons that we're teaching our children is that you can kind of get into trouble and you just rely upon the government to bail you out, or maybe the government's the only one that can bail you out. There's one thing I write in every single quarterly letter to our clients, and I write that financial freedom and independence is primarily in your control. And what you save and invest is more important than anything that goes on in either the markets or the government. So the lessons, unfortunately, that we're teaching our children is that you can get into mortgage trouble and the government will come in and cram down the mortgage rates so that you can afford it. Or they'll force the credit card companies to lower their interest rates, or you don't need to plan for retirement, you know, because Social Security is just fine and it will be solvent. And to people who believe that, I say just try living off what you're expected to get with Social Security now. The most I've ever seen for Social Security projections is just over $2,000 a month. So that's about $24,000 a year at the most. And just try living off the $24,000 a year and put the rest into savings, and now you'll know what it's like to live off of Social Security, and you'll start to grow rich. So,
you know, Greg, you make a great point, and I'm thinking, and it takes me back to the beginning of the show when I talked about yearbooks for everyone. And here you were going out and busting your butt every day and saving up some money at a very young age and buying some property and then working the property. And here we have these kids in Charlottesville High School who are able-bodied, strong, and healthy. They're getting fed on the government dime, so there's no excuse for not having enough calories to work. And yet, we feel that we have to go out and raise money privately, money that could be going to other sorts of charities, that we have to raise this money privately and then give it to kids to buy yearbooks when they could go around the neighborhood and charge maybe $15 or $20 to mow somebody's lawn, and in three lawns they could probably knock out the price of a yearbook. It's disgusting to me, and this is what passes for education these days. All right, we're going to go to the news here. The Shilling Show will return in just a moment with David Murata. 977-1070 is the phone number. Stand by. Thanks for joining us here on The Shilling Show, weekdays from noon to 2, 977-1070 is the phone number. Coming up in the next hour, Supervisor Ken Boyd will be joining us, and we will be taking your calls then and now as we continue our conversation with David Murata. You can visit him online at emurata.com, talking about learning to live on your own. And we do have lines open for you right now at 977-1070. If you need some advice, if you're struggling with some of these financial issues as a parent, or perhaps as a person learning to live on your own, we'd love to hear from you. And David is standing by to answer your questions. So one of the things that came up before the break, we were talking about this issue of the high expectations of today's kids, and you mentioned house size. And I wanted to just give you a little vignette of this that I got from a local developer, because we have this whole issue with quote-unquote affordable housing. And the developer was at a social event one evening, and we were kicking back in somebody's kitchen and talking, and he said, you know, I've been approached by the city council, and they want us to build affordable housing, but here's the problem. The housing that is really affordable is small. and compact. And the people who are in the market for quote unquote affordable housing don't want that. So, you know, we should be building like 1,000 or 1,200 square foot homes. And instead, the people who are the consumers of this are insisting on 2,000 or 2,500 square foot homes. And I think it just paints the picture that this is not just within a household, but this is a societal problem, isn't it?
Yeah, the average household size has been going up pretty much every year since the 1920s. And that's one of the reasons why it's been costing a lot more for people to buy their first house. The first house that we bought, my wife and I, again, we bought a year out of college because we were saving our money and because we were looking for good deals, was 1,156 square feet. And believe it or not, it was a four-bedroom house.
Wow.
And
okay.
And the bedrooms were all like closets, but we had a lot of rooms. It was very snug. It is the right way to say it. But that's the kind of house that you can have, and you can actually raise a family in. You can have a four-bedroom house. We could have had three kids in that house, and everybody could have had their own bedroom.
They did it for generations. It's amazing, isn't it?
They did, and now everyone expects to have a huge house and a huge lawn and very palatial and very modern and no repairs. And again, it's the me generation. I'm going to live beyond my means. I'm going to borrow money. I'm going to inflate the currency, and I'll burden the next generation with all the debt that we generate as a result.
It is amazing. It's 12:37 here on the Shilling Show. 977-1070 is the phone number. Don't wait till the last minute. We have a line open for you right now at 977-1070. And Michael's on line one. Thanks for calling the Shilling Show. You're on with David Murata.
Hi. Thanks, guys. Moving a little away from the political side of things, I am graduating from UVA this weekend and just starting out myself.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be working as a 1099 employee, so I won't have any sort of benefits, but I'm just wondering what's the best sort of retirement package that I need to set up for myself.
Yeah, Michael, great question. Let me answer your question a little bit more generally as well. If you're working for a firm and there's a 401k, take the 401k match. That's the first priority because it's a 50%, it's almost a 50% match, and it's almost like doubling your money immediately. The second priority is one that I would recommend that you take advantage of, and that is a Roth IRA. You are a young college graduate. You will never be paying this little tax again in your life. And so you want to go ahead and pay the tax on the money, put it into a Roth IRA, where it grows tax-free for your entire life, and when you take it out in retirement, it's tax-free. So the tax-free growth on a Roth when you're young is incredibly valuable. The second priority for you is actually a taxable account, and the reason is because you don't want to put it into an IRA because, again, you're not paying that much in tax, and when you take it out of the IRA and you're old and you're rich and because you're a UVA grad and UVA grads make tons of money, you'll be paying too much in tax. So I would do the Roth IRA first and I would do the taxable account second because the taxable growth is only at 15% capital gains. But if you put it in IRA, you're going to have to take it out at ordinary income tax rates later.
Well, okay, excellent. That actually answers exactly what my question was. The last thing to say is that, you know, it's, you know, now just starting out myself and, you know, I'm a victim of this. You know, my parents are obviously baby boomers and, you know, I had never heard of an IRA or a 401k or even, you know, COBRA, what that was and health insurance and how you got it until the last year or so. And so it's been interesting learning all this information. It's been quite eye-opening.
Let me make one more recommendation, and that is regarding health care. Unfortunately, in our society, We have come to think that the only place you can get education is from the public schools, and we've come to think that the only place that you can get health care is from your employer or from some kind of an HMO. I would recommend you're young, you're healthy. Insurance, there's a sense in which insurance doesn't really matter. They just came out with another study that shows that mortality rates for those who have or don't have insurance up to age 64 are equivalent. I would recommend if you're going to get some kind of insurance, you look at the health savings accounts where you put the money in before taxes, so you're paying with pre-tax dollars. And what you're buying is a disaster insurance. For an individual, there's a top limit of like $3,500. So if for some reason you have some medical disaster, the most you're out of pocket is $3,500. Beyond that, everything is paid at 100%. And up to $3,500, you're simply paying your own way with pre-tax dollars that you're putting into your health savings account. And what you're basically doing is you're self-insuring for the most part, and that will make you wiser in terms of your medical decisions and your medical lifestyle. And then for the disaster insurance, you have some insurance. It's very inexpensive that way. It's the right way to do insurance, and it's also the right way if you're young.
Well, thanks very much. It's a great help, and it's great having you on the show, and y'all have a good day.
Thanks for your calling, and again, congratulations to you. And that leaves a line open for you right now at 977-1070. You know, you brought up the HSA, and it's a recommendation to Michael, who is a younger person. I recently opened up an HSA personally this year after thinking about it for years, and I finally got around to it. But do HSAs make sense for most people, or who really should be looking at that as an option?
Yeah, an HSA makes sense for anyone who actually cares about their health, doesn't smoke, doesn't drink a lot, and has basically good health habits. It means that you can pay out of pocket. It makes you ask questions you wouldn't otherwise ask of your doctor about what things will cost. Even if you're going to, probably the one case for a young couple is when they're thinking about having kids, you have to look carefully at pregnancy costs, because they could be prohibitive and that might make a different kind of insurance better. Mm-hmm. But on the whole, the money that you will save with an HSA in just the first year will allow you to hit your deductible in any subsequent year and be still have made money. We have an HSA. We've had it for a long time. We've never hit our deductible. We pay out-of-pocket expenses, so we pay for everything with pre-tax money. The great part about an HSA is not only does it cover medical costs, it covers dental, it covers vision, it covers prescription drugs. So everything that you pay is with pre-tax dollars out of your HSA.
Do you recommend for people that have HSAs that they not take the money out if they don't need to?
We recommend that you go ahead and fund your HSA, and if you can, fund it to the maximum.
Right.
And then some people don't take their money out because they leave it in and they leave it grow. They just keep track of the receipts, which they can then take it out later. That's a little more than I wanted to do, and a little more than I think they might be changing the rules. So we take ours out every year and go ahead and balance the books, but we're putting the maximum in so it's still building up.
News Radio 1070 WINA. It is 12:43 here on The Shilling Show, talking with David Murata, emurata.com online. You can visit him. And when we get back, I want to talk a little bit more about people who are maybe moving out for the first time, rent, automobile, food costs and services, some things that these folks in this position would truly appreciate. The Shilling Show will be right back. Stand by.
I got some troubles, but they won't last. I'm gonna lay right.
It is 12:47 here on The Shilling Show. 977-1070 is the phone number if you have questions or comments for our guest, David Murata. We're talking about learning to live on your own, and it's a good chance for you to ask David some information. He definitely has researched this and has a lot of good suggestions for people, and we will welcome your calls at 977-1070. Okay, so there are a couple things that need to be prioritized when you are heading out on your own, and I think this is something else that's been lost. But let's talk first about maybe the top priority where someone needs to consider spending their money when they're going out on their own.
Yeah, the biggest place you spend your money is probably rent, but you need to keep rent well under 20% of your take-home pay. To lessen the impact, this probably means you're living with roommates. And if you learn nothing else in college, you learned how to live with roommates. And so that's probably the most important thing. And you want to be saving and investing so that you can buy that first house and start participating that way. And then the number two expense is usually car. And again, you need to keep the car costs under 18% of your take-home pay. The best way to buy a car is to pay cash and to buy a junk heap. And then as you can afford to make a better car and you've saved up more money to buy a better junk heap. And the last on the priority would actually be to buy a new car. So new cars lose most of their value in the first 2 years. So at least buy a car that's 2 years old as you go. And only buy a car that you can pay for. Buying a car on credit is probably one of the worst things. The credit is not deductible on your taxes. Mm. And it's just money out the door. And it's a lot harder to pay it back later. Then after rent and transportation comes buying food. The average family spends about 10% of their take-home pay on food. If you don't eat out, then you can spend about 6%. So it's a huge savings whether you eat out or not.
You had an interesting figure about the, was it the cost per calorie or something?
The cost per calorie in restaurants is about 2.5 times as expensive as, as it is eating at home. And the other thing about eating at home is convenience foods are much more expensive than non-convenience foods. I'll never forget, my children hear this all the time, so they've had some great lessons. But I'll never forget my son when he was younger saying, "Yeah, Dad, I understand when I'm out on my own, I'll probably just have to, you know, eat bagged lettuce and stuff like that." And I said, "You realize, of course, that bagged lettuce is a convenience food, and
right.
and most people buy like the head of lettuce, and then they break off the lettuce themselves and they shred the carrots in themselves." And it was at that point he looked at me and he thought, "I have no idea the way you used to live when you were poor," because now your time is more valuable. And when your time is more valuable, then convenience foods make sense. But when you're young, you have time, but you don't have money. And that's the important thing is to try to save money that way. So if you brown bag your lunch, all week, you will basically have an extra $1 million when you retire.
That's amazing.
That's the difference. And as you said, the difference between being rich and being poor is really a lifestyle choice. Wealth is what you save, not what you spend. The poor buy a lot of things. Their houses are cluttered with them. The middle class buys liabilities, things like boats and extra homes, or even memberships. I was just quoted in Money Magazine on anything where you have to pay every single month, that's the first thing to cut out of your lifestyle, because it's a savings every single month that you don't even have to make a choice about. But the rich buy investments, and an investment is anything that pays you money. When Greg bought his, the caller Greg bought his acres of land, he was buying an investment because he could work that land and he could earn money off of it constantly. And unfortunately, because of the market downturn this past fall, I'm afraid that this generation has learned the lesson that the stock market is a great place to lose half your money. And whenever you have a downturn like that, it ends up ruining a generation in terms of saving and investing. The last time that really happened was in the 1970s, the stock market went nowhere. Unfortunately, that was the time in which the baby boomers were coming of age, and they all decided the stock market was a great place to lose money. But Generation X followed them. They came of age in the 1980s, and they realized that the stock market was a great place to make a lot of money. So I would say learn the lessons of history and save and invest.
I think it's interesting, a couple of these issues. You talked about rent and cars, and I think many people have it upside down. I think there's a lot of people who are driving cars that are way beyond their means, a lot of young people, but this goes up into people who are older. They don't lose that sometimes. They're driving cars that they shouldn't be in. They're too expensive. They want to buy it new. And yet they're being evicted from their place for not paying their rent. I've seen it over and over again. How do we get that priority right side up? Is that just because people are susceptible to advertising? Or how is it that they don't understand a roof over their head is more important than a flashy wheels?
You know, I think it takes enough of life to realize that that money spent doesn't really buy you any peace of mind, and it doesn't necessarily buy you any more happiness. I think people are too materialistic. Interestingly enough, materialists have no money in the bank. And I think it's something that's lost on a lot of people. Materialists don't have any savings because they're present hedonists rather than future-oriented savers. And it's the future-oriented savers who are not materialists, and they're the ones who realize that what's more important is the peace of mind of knowing that you can pay your bills and the enjoyment of life, which is not necessarily on spending things. I have seen enough families to know that spending a lot of money does not make people any happier. In fact, it makes them very anxious.
But at some point, you do have to spend your money, or you should. I mean, you don't work to die with it because you can't take it with you. You can certainly pass it on, although the government will take a hefty piece of that in most instances. So how do you advise people to balance those two things, the delaying of present hedonism, but at some point, you do want to enjoy yourself?
Yeah, and the best way is what I call proportional living, and that is you take your take-home pay and you make a pie chart, and 15% goes into saving and investing right off the top. Another 10% goes into an emergency big purchases that you might not otherwise have expected, because the way people get in debt is the carpet leak or the roof leaks, the carpet needs replacing, or they have medical bills and they haven't prepared for it. Another 10%, I recommend that you put a slice of the pie into charity and you actually give your money away. And then after you've got that 35%, then the other 65% is for daily expenses. And if you live proportionally, then what that means is that if you're poor, you'll live like you're poor. And if you're rich, you'll live like you're rich. But in either case, you'll have peace of mind knowing that you can maintain that lifestyle and that you're taking care of yourself.
We talked, David Morata, about people getting this education. And our caller, Michael, who called in a little while ago, had mentioned that his parents really didn't tell him any of this stuff. And they laid it all on him when he was a junior or the year, whatever, the year before he was getting ready to graduate. And it was interesting to me to think about this and then to consider, well, if parents aren't doing it, are the schools doing a good job? And we've got about a minute left to discuss this, but what's your evaluation of schools' teaching of economics?
Yeah, interestingly enough, they've done study after study, and they found that kids who take a class in high school end up worse prepared than those who don't, which is an odd factor. And I think the difference is that it's like riding a bike. What you need is practice handling money, and then the book knowledge just doesn't work. So what I recommend is that parents give their children big swashes of budget that the children then have to manage. Clothing budget is a great place to start. Whatever you spend on your kids for clothing, just give it to them and let them decide what they want to do with it. And 9 times out of 10, they learn to throw it in their sock drawer. They wear ratty clothes, and then they spend the money on what they really want.
You know, that's an interesting lesson. And thinking back, I don't think I ever had that opportunity because my parents always picked out the clothes for me. But I think that, you know, in some ways that's a place where parents could let go a little bit and have that experiment with the kids and let them start understanding the value of prioritization. And I am very concerned about the lack of economic teaching in the schools. I think many kids are graduating from school basically economics deprived and without any solid grip of what economics is.
Yep, we teach kids what we want them to be involved in. So in the schools, we don't teach them about economics. We do teach them about sex ed.
That's right. They, as my old friend George Putnam used to say, they don't know how to read and write, but they sure know how to multiply. David Morata, thank you so much for joining us here on The Shilling Show today and every month. We appreciate it. People can visit you at emorata.com.
Thank you very much.
All right. It is 12:56 here on The Shilling Show. We're heading into a break at the top of the hour. Supervisor Ken Boyd is joining us in the next hour. I know you've got lots of questions for him. There's so much happening in the county right now, and we're going to get into all that stuff after the news. The Shilling Show will return in just a moment. Stand by.